Freestyling the anchor, I'm write that shit. Freestyling the anchor, anchor. Freestyling the anchor, I'm write that shit. Freestyling the anchor. Hey, hey.
Hey, what's up?
It's Ergo.
It is indeed.
I'm Kiss.
I'm Damon.
And what are we doing here, Dame?
We are reshaping culture for the more liberatory and creative, as we always do. Who we got with us today, Kiss?
We're running back the rabbis. This is our second rabbi that we've had,
yes.
Which, you know, wasn't part of the initial plan, but we're searching him out. We're finding good work. First of all, shout out to Tamar Manasseh, we had on 1 Million Experiments. But today we have Rabbi Brant Rosen. Brant is the rabbi and founder of Tzedek Chicago. Tzedek translates to justice. Tzedek is an intentional Jewish congregation based on the core values of justice, equity, and solidarity. It's also one of the few explicitly anti-Zionist Jewish religious spaces. I've been fortunate enough to be a participant in this congregation basically since its founding in 2015. And just finally became a member. I felt like I couldn't have him on the show till I finally became a member, you know?
Mm-hmm. But y'all don't have tithes though, right? Like there's not a dues type of situation going on, is there?
No, there's more of a guilt situation.
Okay.
I'm like, hey, help us out a little. What do you got? You know, it would really be a pity if we couldn't, you know, keep the lights on. but yeah, no, Rabbi Brant is a wonderful spiritual leader, but equally as importantly, has for many years been a leading rabbinical voice around the decolonial fight in Palestine, calling out the hypocrisy of the apartheid state of Israel and the role of American Jewry within that. He's also worked with the American Friends Service Committee and been an organizer around issues here in this country. And I was just really glad to get the chance to learn from him, talk with him, build deeper connection with him as we continue to figure out how to move through, be in solidarity, and make sense of what's happening in Gaza and across the occupied territories.
Yeah, we're really able to highlight some of the importance of the work Jewish Voice for Peace has been doing for many years now, but also open up a vulnerable space to work through the real pain, turmoil, and loss that this time of genocide is bringing for so many.
If you're interested in finding out more about Tzedek, go to tzedekchicago.org. You don't have to be in Chicago. It's a congregation that exists across borders. Everything is available online. And so if you're looking for a Jewish home that's grounded in these values of justice, equity, and solidarity, here is that home for you. You can also, of course, follow Ergo at Ergo Radio. Check out Respair at RespairMedia.com or at Respair Media. And catch us on tour with 1 Million Experiments. I think that's it. You ready to hop in with Brant?
Let's get to it.
Here we go. We are here. We are back. We are so excited to be in the studio in conversation with Rabbi Brant Rosen. I gave the hawk, which actually I was trying to go more like more eagle. There's been a few sightings of a bald eagle right near my house. So I'm feeling that in the spirit, flying down the north branch of the Chicago River, an eagle's been popping in. So you know, maybe, you know, makes a little cameo, but that comes standard, the animal calls. But I do want to start with a very hard-hitting question, which we don't ask everybody. You know, you're someone who on occasion gets up in front of a room of people in different ways to speak, to share your thoughts. And you don't often, I feel like, have walk-up music for the types of speaking you do. And so I'm wondering if you could have any animal noise be your walk-up music, what animal would you choose?
Wow, I was so honored to have the hawk even before I said a word. The first one that comes is coyote.
Ooh.
But I don't know. That's a first impulse. I'd have to give it some thought.
I like that.
No, that's
like
a hot that. That's a hot bird walk-up music. That's solid.
Yeah. I would attempt it myself, but I would not do it justice. So
no, we'll add it in post.
Appreciate it.
With that out of the way, we can start with what we do start every interview with, which is a two-part question that's centered around time. And the question is, in this time, this hour, this day, this season, this lifetime, however you define time, how is the world treating you and how are you treating the world?
Thank you, Daniel and Damon, first of all, for having me. I'm really honored to be having this conversation with you both. The world's treating me pretty well. I don't have any major complaints. I'm very, very blessed. those I love are doing reasonably well. I'm doing reasonably well. I'm counting my blessings right now, for sure. How am I treating the world? I try. I try. It's a hard question for me to answer. You know, you'd have to probably answer, you know, those who are part of my world, those who are part of my community. But I try to treat the world with compassion and kindness and, you know, fairness. Sometimes I succeed, probably sometimes not so well, but that's my ongoing intention, at least.
This is definitely a safe space for the distance between ideal and reality. That's part of the work. We have another tradition, which I feel like is a good place to start, which we colloquially term giving some gas. It's an opportunity to celebrate, lift up, affirm the person we're talking to. And so we're recording this in the midst of the ongoing onslaught in Gaza, and then the ripples and concurrent tensions building out of that. And one of the things that I've come back to a lot for me is the ability to have had a space to process some of these contradictions before this activated moment. And that has happened in different ways, but a lot of that has happened, you know, kind of in the care and in the hands of the things and the spaces you've made. And so, one, thank you for having done that work of building a space where, like, in all of the difficulty of this time, I wasn't confronting these contradictions for the first time, and I had felt like I had a home in that. And I'm wondering for you, how equipped have you felt? Forget about as a leading voice, as an organizer, but as just a human over the last, you know, 100 plus days, like just getting through the day, figuring out how to be wide-eyed and okay.
Yeah, that's a great question. I feel similar to you. I feel like I'm part of a space where I'm really able to be my full authentic self, both as, you know, as a person of conscience and as a Jew and as a rabbi. And I feel very, very, very blessed that is the situation. You know, the day-to-day, they're doing the triage of what is the best use of my time, what is the most important thing for me to be doing at this moment. That will always be an ongoing struggle, for sure. And it can be an exhausting process of discernment at any given moment. But in the big picture, you know, just to give a little bit of background, you know, I was for 16 years, I was at another congregation in Evanston, Jewish Reconstructionist Congregation. That was my world. And that was the place I thought I would retire from. It was really, you know, professionally and personally, my place. And I left that congregation in 2014 in the midst of another Israeli onslaught on Gaza. And it was a long time in coming, but I left under duress because I was not able to be my full authentic self on what was going on. And I knew that speaking out and being involved publicly in standing with Palestinians in that moment was going to rip the congregation apart. So I left. And when I left, I didn't think I would work as a congregational rabbi anymore. In fact, I was pretty sure I wasn't. And I immediately started working for the American Friends Service Committee. I worked for the Quakers for 5 years.
Quakers are interesting.
The Quakers are interesting. Yeah.
Quakers are quaking, you know?
Yeah. But I will say they, you know, it was a very, in many ways, a very, very hospitable home for me, where I could exhale for the first time and speak my truth. I worked as the Midwest Regional Director out of the Chicago office, and they have a very, did and continue to have a very robust Israel-Palestine program, which we could talk about. But, you know, I was a rabbi working for a Quaker peace and justice organization. And we started me and some friends started a small congregation on the side. It was really a side hustle for me. It was really, we created it for ourselves. We just wanted a place to be Jewish, you know, as people who were Jews, who stood in solidarity with Palestinians, who were anti-Zionist, who, you know, just didn't have any other place to be. And it grew and grew, eventually became a congregation. And I ended up doing that full time again. I left AFSC at the end of 2019. You know, it was not something that was I ever expected to happen, but to be the rabbi of a congregation that unabashedly, as part of its core values, stands with all people who are oppressed, including Palestinians, and is seeking to build a Judaism beyond Zionism, where in this moment now, I can just be totally and wholly myself. As I said before, it's a huge blessing. I have many rabbinic colleagues who are being torn apart in this very moment in a way similar to me, back in the day. And it's what's happening in the Jewish community right now is almost carnage, I think. But it's nothing. I need to say it's absolutely nothing compared to the carnage that Palestinians in Gaza are going through. And I really want to make that clear, that whatever discomfort I feel or any of us feel, you know, the first order of business is the genocide that's happening right now in real time.
To jump back, I feel like the rabbinical group chats, it's been an interesting time, you know. And I feel like those are probably some long messages. I feel like we're stretching the blue bubble limits here.
And most of those I'm not in. You know, I'm in Jewish Voice for Peace has a rabbinical council. I'm in those group chats. I'm in the Rabbis for Ceasefire chats. But my own denomination, I'm not part of those chats. It's just not where I need to be right now. I don't know if I can ever be there, actually.
And so I want to go back even further in this story, because you named this moment in 2014 and as like a precursor to the, you know, moral catastrophe and being equipped to stand in your truth and stand on the side of justice right now. It sounds like you were already had been provoked and already had a grounding. And so I'm curious what the spark was that spark for that was. Were there mentors or elders, or was it in your household, or was it a struggle to get to that place initially? And what was like kind of the moment in time that pushed your consciousness to being so steadfast on, you know, the solidarity of liberation?
Yeah. You know, I, for most of my life up until, you know, I guess relatively recently in the scheme of things, I would say I was this white Jewish liberal guy, maybe on the more left edge of that world, you know, and I was raised in a home, that liberal Jewish community, but Zionism and Israel was a part of the mix always. So I identified deeply with Israel. You know, I think as I grew into adulthood, I started to harbor real questions, deep-seated questions about what is this allegiance to a ethnic Jewish state in historic Palestine, and why does that need to be part of, you know, what it means to be Jewish, and how does it jibe with some of the other assumptions I've been taught, values I've been taught about, you know, equality and democracy and, you know, liberation. You know, when I became a rabbi, I started to struggle even more deeply with it, and that struggle had, you know, the consequences of that struggle were heightened because I was a public figure. But I was always public about my struggle, for better or worse. It was not strategic. It's just, I'm the kind of person that it's in my head and it's out my mouth always, as my loved ones will attest. I just had these questions about, you know, what was and is referred to as liberal Zionism, which is just it's not a term I use anymore. I think it's a horribly oxymoronic term. There's nothing liberal about ethno-nationalism and settler colonialism. But I started just harbor deep-seated questions and was very open with that struggle. And in 2006, I started blogging, you know, back when blogging was all the rage. I still write on a blog, by the way. I'm hopelessly passé.
The ancient scrolls that blogs.
That's right, the ancient scrolls. I mean, I guess Medium is now an ancient scroll, right? You know, I'm still blogging away.
You still hold it down.
Yeah, not through any devotion to the medium, just because that's, you know, it's just easy for me to do. That was a mechanism for me just to share my thoughts with my congregation and the greater world. And, you know, and in the beginning, I just blogged. It was before social media, really. I blogged about all kinds of different silly things, but also political conviction. So the first, you know, Damon, to answer your question more directly, the first real turning point for me was another onslaught on Gaza, actually. Gaza always seems to be sort of the linchpin, as it is, I think, for many Jews. But in 2008, the end of 2008, early 2009, there was an onslaught on Gaza that Israel called Operation Cast Lead. And this was a few years after the blockade started. And I had already been pretty public about my opposition to the blockade. When I read the reports on the initial reports coming out of Gaza, something kind of snapped in me. It was like, I can't do this anymore. And I wrote a very, very pointed blog post that basically said that and said, this is an outrage. I'm tired of making apologies. I think the title of it was No More Apologies. And, these are war crimes and this needs to stop. And you know, it was very publicly breaking with this, you know, liberal Zionist narrative. That was the beginning of this new trajectory for me. And, you know, I got very involved publicly with Jewish Voice for Peace. The membership of Jewish Voice for Peace always skyrockets at times like this, which it is right now, as people can see in the streets. I became very publicly active in the Palestine Solidarity Movement as a Jew and as a rabbi. And I was, as I said, it was in my head, out my mouth. It was not strategic. I didn't really think about the consequences inside my congregation. But to their credit, the leadership of the congregation really, because I had been there for some time and I guess had amassed some level of trust, the leadership of the congregation worked hard to make it work. And even if they didn't fully agree with me, many of them absolutely did not agree with me, but we struggled hard to make it work for many years until 2014, when, as I said, it became intolerable. I think my behavior was intolerable to certain quarters of my congregation, and my inability to unabashedly speak my truth and be active as a matter of conscience, which is, I think, what all people should be doing, let alone clergy. It caused so much of a ruckus inside my congregation that I ended up resigning and leaving.
So I've heard in various spaces pieces of that story and the activation politically and the repercussions. But what I haven't had the chance to ask is the activation draw, is the path of what brought you into being interested in being a rabbi in the first place. And in the interest of mapping those intersections between those two paths and also marking them as not inherently one and the same, I'm curious where that story begins, where that became something that when you looked at what your life would be, you're like, yeah, I want to try to fill that role.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that question. Yeah, I'm not one of those people who will say ever since I was a kid, I wanted to be a rabbi. I was actually last year, I was at my high school reunion. And the night before it, I went out to dinner with a bunch of old Hebrew school friends. We were very tight in Hebrew school. We were actually a notorious group of kids who chewed up our teachers and spit them out.
All the best kids are the raucous Hebrew school kids. You know, the goody two-shoe Hebrew school kids. You don't want to mess with them now.
Yeah, they disappear and they're never heard from again, you know. My best friend, I mean, when I look back, my best friends in the world were, you know, back when I was in middle and high school, were that group of people. And, you know, we sort of kept in touch over the years. But anyways, we went out to dinner and we were sort of going around the table, you know, and we're all, you know, 60-something now, and going around the table and catching up and saying, you know, what we do. And then we came to me and I said, well, I guess you're all wondering how I ended up becoming a rabbi. They were like, yeah. Because I was a bad kid in Hebrew school. So when I was in college, I went to UCLA. I'm from Los Angeles, and I went to UCLA as an undergrad. And I was on, you know, kind of a spiritual search, as many are at that age. And, you know, I kept coming back to Judaism for no other reason than that was my inherited tradition. And it always felt like I was dabbling, you know, when I was, you know, seeking out in other places. And it was like, well, why not just mine my own legacy and heritage? And so I became more involved in Jewish life. I lived at this funky Jewish co-op on campus. And then I actually took time off 2 years and went to Israel, lived in Israel for 2 years, and did all kinds of different things. I lived on a kibbutz for most of that time, but I also part of that program was taking classes at Hebrew Union College, which was in Jerusalem. And that's the rabbinical seminary for the Reform Movement. So I was taking classes with first year rabbinical students and getting to know them and just thinking, that was when the seed was planted, to answer your question, that I thought, I don't know if it was being a rabbi per se, but I loved the studying. I loved those studies. And, you know, I was young. I was 21 at the time. So, you know, graduating and then going to rabbinical school for another 5 years and just immersing myself in this learning, it was very exciting to me. And I thought, you know, rabbis do all kinds of different things. I'll figure that out. I knew I did not want to be a congregational rabbi when I started, actually. I thought Jewish congregations, synagogues were just horribly, you know, middle-class places. And my own experiences growing up at a synagogue was not a positive one. So I didn't really have a game plan. Again, you see probably a pattern developing.
I'm loving this theme of we just go with the flow. We let it loose. We let it ride.
I make shit up as I go along. Yeah. So I went back home and all of my friends, including my then girlfriend, my now wife, had graduated.
You made it. All right.
Yeah. But I had not. They all had moved on with their lives. I still had, you know, a few years left to finish. And so I finished up, but it pretty much made the decision I wanted to go to rabbinical school when I graduated. So I went to the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College, which is in Philadelphia. Hallie and I got married. We moved to Philadelphia. There's no way in hell I'll ever be a congregational rabbi. I thought I'll be a different kind of rabbi, you know, and what that actually literally meant, I could not have told you. But in the meantime, I was 24. I was going to be studying for 5 years. When you're 24, 5 years is like an eternity, you know? I mean, oh my God, I'm going to be pushing 30 when I graduate, you know? I'll figure it out. So that sort of emerged out of that. But I was not, you know, kind of cut from the cloth of many clergy in that I was always kind of uncomfortable public speaking. I'm not always so comfortable being in the public eye or the center stage. It's something I've really had to learn and grow into. I have a healthy ego like everybody, but I didn't become a rabbi for ego reasons. It was really something that evolved and emerged over time. And I ended up being almost exclusively a congregational rabbi in the end. I've managed to find congregations where I've been able to do exciting work. You know, it's all sort of been leading up to this moment where I feel like I've been able to help create a new kind of congregation that is really very, very deeply, sorely needed in the world right now.
So something Daniel has talked to me about a lot is the Reconstructionist tradition. So if you could kind of just frame that space, because where I want to go next, I'm going to pull back the curtain. I want to go into entering JVP. I'm curious if there are ways that the seeds planted in the Reconstructionist space, like, made that journey fluid for you. So for those who are unfamiliar, can you frame that for us?
Sure. And those who are unfamiliar with Reconstructionism it's a pretty large group of folks, I realize. So I should never assume that people know what I'm talking about when I use that term, you know, in passing.
You're like the black codes? What are you talking about?
Yeah, right. You're right. That's right. This is like post-Civil War, right? You're part of the Reconstruction. I once met an ultra-Orthodox Jew and he said, oh, you're Reconstructionist. So what are you reconstructing? So the Reconstructionist movement is a denomination of Judaism alongside Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox. It's an American Jewish denomination, meaning we have affiliated congregations. There is a rabbinical school where they train their own rabbis and that serve those congregations, and also a rabbinical association where the rabbis are affiliated. So that's kind of the definition of a denomination. But the ideology of Reconstruction has been around for since the early 20th century. It's a very uniquely American approach to Judaism.
Which may sound old to folks listening, but in the Jewish tradition, that's like a baby, right?
a baby. Yes. It is. It's very recent. And I mean, you think of the centuries of Jewish history, and it was a movement of Jewish modernity. And, you know, and it emerged during a time in which lots of modern Jewish movements were emerging. And it was also a very uniquely American approach to being Jewish. It emerged out of the question of, well, what is it in this unprecedented new time where Jews were part of, coming into their own in an open and pluralistic democratic society and coming out of, you know, these smaller, more rarefied communities? What does that mean? How do we understand ourselves as Jews and being part of this whole? And the founder of Reconstructionism was an American rabbi named Mordechai Kaplan, who was a very influential American Jewish thinker. He was affiliated with the conservative movement for most of his adult life. He taught at the Jewish Theological Seminary, which is the conservative movement seminary in New York. He was a very prolific writer, and he was the rabbi, founded a congregation in New York City, the Upper West Side, that still exists, the Society for the Advancement of Judaism. He started a journal called the Menorah Journal, which was very influential back in those days. And the ideas that he was propagating about Judaism became known as Reconstructionism. His first, one of his early books, which was kind of his magnum opus, was called Judaism as a Civilization Toward a Reconstruction of American Jewish Life. So that's where the word Reconstructionism came from. And basically, his approach was that Judaism is not just a religion. It is not, it is not just a culture, and it's certainly not like an ethnicity or anything like that, but it's what he called a civilization. It's a totality that incorporates all of these things. As he put it, it's an evolving religious civilization, so that what it means to be Jewish has been changing and evolving over time. And in fact, that's been the secret of our longevity, is that we've been able to evolve and adapt and kind of have an organic relationship with the cultures in which we've lived throughout the diaspora over the years. And having that kind of symbiotic relationship has been key, you know, because if Judaism was just about being Jewish, was this one static thing, we would have gone extinct a long time ago. So evolution wasn't only an explanation, but it was something that was desired. You know, we should be actively involved in the evolution and the ongoing bringing forward of Jewish life. And in America, that meant all kinds of good stuff like, you know, equal rights and democracy and pluralism and civil rights and bringing that to bear on what it means to be Jewish. So he wanted it to be an ideology that influenced all of American Jewish life. But the second generation of his disciples really prevailed upon him to start a movement in order to allow these ideas to really live on. And his son-in-law, Ira Eisenstein, was kind of the leader of that group. And they started forming Reconstructionist congregations. And then the college, the rabbinical college, was founded in 1968. And so really, we're talking quite recent in terms of a movement. And the movement has been, you know, has been evolving and changing in many ways past the initial nature of what it was, because, you know, the world, America and the world is very different in 2024 than it was, you know, early 20th century, needless to say. A lot has happened in the 20th century, and a lot seems to be happening in the 21st.
This is a little ergo throwback, but it's a game that we have played that I feel like this is a prime opportunity for. So we have activated beef, like, you know, conflict as a, you know, an important tool. And we got into this practice of starting beef with the 20th century because we feel like things really just got out of hand. And so we'll come back to this trajectory we're talking, but I feel like you should have the opportunity here and now to start beef with the 20th century. What's a piece, a person, a phenomenon, an experience, ideology that we can just really like square up with here? Beef with the 20th century.
I immediately go to the obvious. That's okay, right? I mean, I can.
No. It's not a trick question. Like I said, things got out of hand.
Things got out of hand. You know, I mean, I'm tempted to say, well, Hitler, you know, really fucked things up. But, you know, I just recently watched a little documentary on PBS about the early American Nazi Party and, among other things, how German Nazis, National Socialists took their cue from a lot of stuff that was going on in the United States. So it would be way too easy for me to put it all on Hitler and National Socialism. I think fascism and white supremacy, and which emerges part and parcel with colonialism, and which is well predates the 20th century, of course. I'm beefing about fascism.
Yeah, that's fair. Great answer.
I'm sure I'm not unique in the people you've posed that question to.
That's a tried and true answer to this question, absolutely.
And, you know, I'm also beefing about the people who thought, you know, when the war was over that we'd somehow vanquished it, and, you know, for sleeping at the wheel and not realizing that it was just waiting for its moment. There's still those who aren't quite, you know, convinced that this is real, you know. That it's just some kind of little blip. Happy little liberalism can, you know, keep at bay. So, but I wanted to just finally, Damon's point about Reconstruction, a question about Reconstructionism, that I came to my current way of thinking as a Reconstructionist. I'm still very much a Reconstructionist. You know, the pedagogy of Reconstructionism, of embracing the evolution of Judaism and taking the highest values that you're surrounded by in the world that you live and bring them to bear to make Judaism better and vice versa, is, you know, what brought me to this point of standing in solidarity with Palestinians. And, you know, I don't think it's any coincidence that by far the largest number of anti-Zionist rabbinical students and new rabbis are coming out of the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College. Unfortunately, the movement leadership has not been able to take that step, and they're not making life easy for the anti-Zionists in the movement. But to me, even though I left, I'm not the rabbi of a Reconstructionist congregation anymore. I still feel very much that this is the pedagogy. This is my view of the world that I wake up with every morning, you know.
As I'm hearing that, one, it just like makes sense to a lot of the conversations Daniel and I have had. And two, it really parallels or mirrors or is like braided with, we use the word dialectics to kind of describe creating a context in which you are consistently holding, finding, and pushing to reconcile contradiction, as opposed to saying static and seeing, you know, reality as one way. Like what I hear in this tradition is, through this push towards evolving, right, that allows to see where the ideals no longer meet the time, or where the time pushes towards the need for new ideals. And so I want to push us towards some of the movement moment we're in now, but also want to frame or contextualize the space. We've talked about it before, but it's been a while, of JVP, Jewish Voice for Peace, because it is, I have a deep empathy right now of one, like, pride of, I think it is important for everyone to resist within their space, and particularly when their identity is being held or being privileged in a certain way. But two, just the influx of showing up, I think, on the right side of history right now. JVP has really been at the forefront of that and have laid a lot of ground for there to be this contention that I don't think folks saw before. Like, I don't think before these last 100 days, the general public was as aware of this anti-Zionist Jewish tradition that is, I think, growing in really important ways. So I'm curious for you, what did you know Jewish Voice for Peace, or JVP, to be when you first found it or introduced to it? And what has grown or changed or expanded or shifted to where you see it to be now?
Thanks. Yeah, but I'm so happy to hear you say that, you know, and to hear how you're responding to this, because there have always been Jewish anti-Zionists, you know, and in this moment, I've been so much part of this movement that sometimes it's hard for me to step outside and see the way that it's being perceived or impacting. And so it's very gratifying to hear you say those words. You know, so I remember in my former congregation, there was always a small number of pretty radical, who I would consider then to be radical Jews, who were involved in kind of proto-JVP activity. And JVP is a national organization that started by combining lots of local Jewish groups around the country that were standing in solidarity with Palestinians. And Jewish Voice for Peace, that was actually a group, a local group in San Francisco that was very robust and ended up reformatting and becoming a national umbrella for a lot of these groups and then started chapters. But in Chicago, there was a group called Not in My Name. And this was in the late 90s. And it was pretty, it was infamous in the Jewish community. They were vilified, and there was a small number of people in my congregation who were active in Not in My Name. And I was always like, this is so interesting. Like, I wasn't quite ready to go there, but I knew they existed. And it was really important to me that they existed, you know. And around the same time, there were other people out there. There was, who's become one of my best friend, dearest friends, a rabbi named Alyssa Wise, who was part of JVP staff for many years and is now the lead founder of Rabbis for Ceasefire. And kind of one of my ongoing, partners in crime in many different projects over the years. But I learned about her when she was in rabbinical school, and I read an interview with her, and she refused to do the year in Israel. There's an Israel year in rabbinical school, and she refused to do it and was studying at Beer Zeit University instead in the West Bank. And she did an interview with this blog as an anti-Zionist Jew. And she wrote a blog herself called The Palestinian Talmud. And I was just reading this interview and going, what? Who is this? What is she? And I didn't, again, I wasn't ready to go to that place, but I knew that there were people like this out there. And that was really significant. And then as I started to evolve, I remember, I've told her the story, I just reached out to her. I picked up the phone and cold called her and wanted to talk. JVP was important in so many ways because I was aware that this was a thing. And even if I wasn't quite ready to become part of it, I knew that it was real and it was ready for me when I was. In 2008, when I started going down that path, it was enormously important to me that there was this Jewish address where I could hang my hat and be, and they were ready to embrace me with open. They knew who certainly the members
Come
of my congregation
who
were very yeah, it's like, we've been waiting, we've been giving you space. But so it's grown by leaps and bounds since then. Alyssa and I founded the Rabbinical Council back in 2007, I think it was. It was later than that. Anyways, I can't remember anymore. But back in the day, I became very, very involved on a national level. And one of the things I'm aware of now is the way I think about it sometimes is doing the inside game versus the outside game. And for many years, I was working the inside game. I was really trying to change things from within this conventional Jewish communal structure. But it was important to me that there were people doing the outside game. And now I'm fully positioned on the outside. And I can't tell you how many times I get these cold calls, like the time I called Alyssa, and people just call me up and say, I've known about you, I've known about your congregation, and I just want to talk. I just want to learn, and or I want to join the congregation, or I want to join JVP. So I think it's really important to have people who will just plant their flag. This is what I am. I'm not where you are. But you know, if and when you're ready to come join, we'll happily receive you. You know, we're here. I think in this current moment, you know, there are the numbers of people who are seeking out folks who are playing the outside game. Those numbers are skyrocketing. You know, there are people who are members of the Jewish community, largely young people, but not only, who are, you know, can't bear the Jewish community, the conventional Jewish community anymore. It's not a place they want to be. And they're despairing. Is there a place for me? And thankfully, places like JVP exist. And the influx of these young people, a lot of what you're seeing in the streets is through the leadership of some amazingly gifted organizers who are taking the lead. And at this point, I'm kind of an elder now, which is, you know, mostly cool. It's sometimes a little disconcerting.
Do you feel like there's an expectation that the beard should be longer? Is that what this is? Like, what's the disconcerting part? Yeah.
The disconcerting part is wait a minute, I'm old?
Just mortality.
Maybe I should shave that beard. But no, it's just really cool that, you know, it's a real robust movement that, you know, and as Damon said, that you're noticing it, that it's the New York JVP took over the Statue of Liberty and said Gaza must be free and held that ground with banners for hours. You know, it's breathtaking and so important. And I know how important it is to lots of people, including Palestinians.
Yeah, I think that point is something that I've felt a lot of, how many people who are struggling with figuring out how to externalize the internal thoughts of what they know to be right are struggling because they're afraid of losing their spiritual communal home. And that isn't an excuse, but it is an understandable feeling if you feel that that is what's on the line. And I agree that the only counter to that is the collective alternative that exists now. It's not just, look, there are some people who agree with you. It's like, no, there's another home for you here that's really the same home all along. Like, we're doing the same thing. This has always been part of our tradition. There are spaces in conflict, in contradiction, in argument, in tension, that's like as much as anything else is baked into the ritual, is that tension and living in argument and disagreement. And that really the thing that the isolation, the fear of that isolation for disagreeing, to me, feels like profoundly in opposition to the religious practice and to the spiritual practice of it. Does that ring true?
Yeah, no, that's really well put. I mean, it's only being true to the values we were taught in Hebrew school. you know, that's the thing. And that's the mind game that Zionism has played on us, is that, you know, Zionism was a movement. Yeah, I mean, it depends on your relationship to the word radical, you know, but, you know, I'm using it in the terms of, it was radically overturning what it had meant to be Jewish for centuries up until that point. It was, we were joking about recent movements. Well, Zionism was a recent movement. It was one of those movements of modernity that I was talking about. And it was subverting everything that Judaism had been up until that point. And after the Holocaust and after the State of Israel was created, it went from being this, you know, one of many different upstart modern movements to be taking this pride of place at the center of the Jewish community and somehow created this illusion that that's what it's always been to be Jewish. And it's not. It's not. It's absolutely not. You know, Judaism has not been about nation statism and colonialism and dispossessing people from their land and committing state violence against them because they're not part of this dominant group that you're trying to establish. I mean, we have been victims of that for centuries, you know. I mean, I think I can paint a portrait as to why it turned out this way, but it doesn't have to be this way. It shouldn't be this way. And I think now in particular, there's a new generation of young Jews who just aren't buying that narrative anymore. They're just not. It's just patently obvious to them. For me, it took years of struggle to get to that point, but there are now people who, you know, see it immediately, you know, and in this current moment, you know, if you don't see it now in this current moment, you know, then God help you.
I agree. And you're a rabbi. So what do we do for that?
How do you help God help?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
obviously every person isn't your or our responsibility in that way, but there is this feeling that Damon mentioned earlier of organizing within your homes, basically collective homes. And so I'm wondering, I've heard you talk in this conversation about your journey of movement into participation and the steadfastness that you walk now. I've seen in myself and in other people like that journey through participating within the congregation that you've built. And that's beautiful work. And then there's the like oppositional work. People within this larger Jewish umbrella who are in direct opposition to what we are holding. And so, yeah, I'm wondering how you think of the, you know, what do we owe to each other? To people who, you know, if not, we're not connected, we're affiliated.
I mean, this is a really, really hard question. I mean, hard, like painfully hard. And I'll just be honest with you, in this moment, Jews that support genocide are not my people. They're just not. I'm not interested in finding common cause with them. I'm not interested in working with them. I'm not interested in trying to reach them. I don't want anything to do with them. I don't want anyone who considers genocide to be either actively promoting it, of which there are plenty, or those who just, you know, rationalize it away, which is tantamount to supporting it. And I think many of us are reconsidering who is our community? You know, I mean, right now, marching in the streets with Palestinians and allies and Jews and others alike, that's where I feel most at home. You know, I guess it goes back to what I was saying before about the outside game. I feel like I know most in the Jewish community, in the organized Jewish community. I use that term advisedly. You know, it's the community is a wide and vast and complex place, but the so-called Jewish establishment want nothing to do with me. Not only that, and people like me, they vilify us, they call us self-hating and terrorists and, you know, et cetera. And I feel like going back to the outside game, I'm just planting my flag and saying, this is where I am. This is my Judaism and my human conscience. And if you want to join me, fine. And if you're going to fight me, I don't have any responsibility to you. I don't want to waste my time trying to reach you. I'm not going to try to convince you to accept things that you're not prepared to accept. I think maybe there's a schism. And I know that's a strong word, but, you know, these are fissures, fault lines that have existed for a long, long time. And I think now, since October 7th, I think they've widened into abysses. You know, there have been schisms in Jewish history before. This is not new. So I know that sounds harsh, but that's how I'm feeling right now. If you're a Jew who supports genocide, I'm you're not for me. I'm going to fight you. I'm not going to try to reach you or make any kind of common cause with you because you happen to be Jewish.
I pretty much agree. And it makes me really sad.
It's really heartbreaking because
much of what I have found home, power, strength in my Jewishness is this feeling of this larger we that I don't know that exists across diaspora, around the world, that there's this feeling of I walk into a synagogue or I'm even in the Jewish quote quarter of, you know, these European cities and the remnants, the relics, the walls have this thing that I'm in this beautiful, abstract, but internal, embodied way connected to. And the cost of that loss feels so, yeah, heartbreaking.
Maybe a good metaphor to use is that we're this big, and have always been this big, dysfunctional family. And, you know, family members become estranged from one another. And that doesn't, you're still in the family. I mean, nobody gets, you know, pushes your buttons more than family members. All of that still holds. We are connected, you know, on some level, but we're in a moment of deep estrangement right now. And, you know, my wife and I were in Copenhagen in early December, and there was a Jewish synagogue there, and Jewish life in Copenhagen in Denmark was really interesting. And, you know, we would have gone into that synagogue. We heard it was really beautiful, but we saw We Stand With Israel signs and things. And I couldn't do it. You know, that's how I feel about most synagogues in this country and most Jewish circles. But we're creating new ones. You know, we are creating new ones that are places where we feel our Jewish consciences can blossom. And, you know, they're still a bit on the borderlands of Jewish life, but they exist and they're growing. And I think they have a future.
That experience you just named of the, like, I can't walk in that door. I had a similar experience in November that was maybe a little bit more internalized, but I got married in early October and we were in Mexico City. And you know how when you're walking down the street, even if there's not a sign, you're like, I have a feeling that's a synagogue. Like you can kind of, there's something in the air. Like there wasn't a sign. Often it was like set aside from the street, but you could see this little stained glass window. And, you know, I had been in deep grief and confusion. It was, you know, 3 weeks after October 7th. And my wonderful partner and now wife was holding me in all of those contradictions. And, you know, also has in all of our travels seen me search out these spaces where I feel that connection. And she was like, let's go see if we can, you know, poke our head in. And I was resistant in a way that I haven't been before. But she was like, no, maybe it'll feel good to feel connected to your people in this moment, right? You know, I'm struggling with this, like, are they my people feeling? And so we walked around to the other side of the building where the entrance is. And it happened to be a Saturday. And, you know, there's a security guard. And my Spanish is okay, but she speaks fluently and, you know, asks, can we come in? And the security guard says, can I see your IDs? And so we start taking out our IDs. And before we can even show them the IDs, he says, you can't come in. And she says, why not? And he says, it's against the rules. You know, and someone from the congregation had come out and was looking at us through the window. And, you know, we're not in our Shabbos clothes. We're walking the streets. And, you know, she became protective in a certain way. She's like, well, why can't, like, what is the rule? Tell me. And I just like crumbled in on myself of, you know, and I was like, we have to go. We have to leave right now. And, you know, we made about halfway down the block and I broke down. And it felt like this very visceral affirmation of the thing you're naming of, like, whether it's by my choice. And, you know, this may not have been tied. This wasn't a personal necessarily attack on me. This was a triggering of this feeling of, like, this space that I've always imagined as being a place I could walk into for multiple reasons is closed to me. That was, yeah, part of the heartbreak of this moment.
Yeah, right. You know, it probably wasn't personal, but it sure felt personal.
Right. And I could be sympathetic of, like, in a time of heightened fear and, you know, there's only so many Jews in Mexico and this is one of five synagogues and we look like, you know, lefty could be protest. Like, who the hell knows what the hell we want to do inside that building? So I get it. And it was just this, like, yeah, that internal schism you're describing. I'm glad you exist and the aesthetic exists, is what I'm saying.
Thank you. Know? Well, likewise. Yeah. And there have been times in Jewish history where Jews have had to take precautions, you know, in Christian medieval Europe, you know, around Easter, you know, I don't think synagogues were open to strangers. you know, but we grew up in the era of, you know, like if you do a Passover Seder, you invite everyone, you know, it's like all who are hungry come and eat. And I had friends who, you know, non-Jewish friends who were always trying to score an invitation to a Jewish Seder, you know, that's like what it meant to be Jewish. And now that we're in this moment where Jews are being barred at the door of synagogue, like it's just, yeah, it's almost incomprehensible, but it's not unprecedented.
I want us to end with the opportunity for big picture reflections, but there, I think one important shift that I just want to make space for, because it's easy to talk about solidarity in the abstract or with distance of like, I read this article or I saw this footage or there is this collective moment happening that I feel responsible or connected to. But I want to make space in this moment for the leadership and relationship and connection of Palestinian folks. Like, you know, where has there been grace? You know, you said many times, like, the importance and centering the experience of what Palestinians are going through in this time. And so for you in this journey that we've covered over the last 15 to 20 years, I'm curious, in direct relationship or communication, interaction beyond what you saw in the news or saw someone else report on, that you've seen the leadership of Palestinians in this struggle against, you know, this genocide that has made space for this work that has, you know, shaped your life.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's been my friendships and relationships with Palestinians that have really helped me. I would not be in the place that I am personally without those relationships. And it's really, there's a tension. I mean, it's tricky because it's not their job to educate me. It's not their job to bring me along, you know. But at the same time, you know, allyship is really important. And I know the deeper those relationships are and the deeper the trust is, the less that becomes an issue. You know, it's interesting, but it's really important for Jewish allies of Palestinians, and especially white Jewish allies of Palestinians, to not tokenize them and not, you know, it can easily fall into that. So consciously stepping back, you know, JVP is a Palestine solidarity organization. It's actually one of the largest in the world, kind of, it may be the largest, which is kind of amazing. From terms of sheer membership. The basic mission of a Palestine solidarity organization is to free Palestine. That is their basic raison d'etre. And to put it really simplistically, once Palestine is free, there won't be a need for JVP, you know, or other organizations like it. But at Tzedek Chicago, our mission is building a Jewish community. And that is a permanent job. That will always be important. It's important for me to keep those things separate. You know, many of us at Tzedek are members of JVP. Many. The Venn diagram is very, very thick, but it's different work, you know, and I don't want or expect Palestinians to help me be a better Jew. Early on, the year before we started Tzedek, when we were still kind of a group of people doing these things, we did a Palestine Solidarity Seder. It was a Seder, during the week of Passover, and I invited some Palestinian friends of mine to speak about the Nakba and to as part of the Seder. I did that because they were my friends and they were happy to do it and it was fine. But looking back on that, I would never do that again. I would never, never put a Palestinian in that kind of a situation to help enhance my Seder, you know? And so, but I'm absolutely ready to show up as an ally whenever needed. And so
from that, I'm taking, where do we show up, right? Like, that learning is important, but we should show up to their space when invited or when welcome to do that learning instead of,
when invited or when asked and to follow their lead.
And there's still ways to share their words and experiences without asking labor.
Yes, true. And that we do. And, you know, it depends on my individual relationship with an individual person. I mean, the ones who spoke at the Seder, they were gracious. They were happy to do it. They were, you know, fine with it. But it was just a learning experience for me in trying to be really clear about what I'm doing at any given point and why I'm doing it and what's the goal of what it is that I'm doing.
I want to be a little mindful of time, and I think we can move toward wrapping. But I do have just one message for you from Rosie, my partner. She just wanted me to let you know that you run a hell of a Rosh Hashanah service. She stepped into it this year. She just wanted me to let you know. And the flip side of that is something that is 100% not your fault and is 100% my fault, which is this was the first year that she came with me. And you know, I'm giving her a little bit of the lay of the land of here's what to expect. She's asking some questions. And she was like, so how long is it, roughly? And in my mind, in my like, just out of the, you know, quick response, I was like, this isn't the long one. Yom Kippur is the long one. So this is like, you know, an hour and a half, something like that. Ah. And boy, did I fuck up.
I bet you didn't come back for Yom Kippur.
No, she got everything she needed. Let's put it that way. But she had nothing but loving things to say about the space you made. Pointed, loving, harsh critique for me for underestimating the length of the 3 hours. So I just wanted to let you know.
I'm glad to let you take the fall
absolutely
for the latter one.
You know, we hold each other, the rabbinic leader is responsible for a lot, but that one, that's on me, you know?
Well, please let her know that, you know, at our Friday night services, they're less than an hour, sometimes even a half an hour. I'm a less is more kind of person. That's the irony of this. But High Holidays is just an unwieldy beast of a service, you know.
I say that to say, as I've said several times through this conversation, thank you for making a space real that I don't know where I would have found a home for this last, you know, near decade if that hadn't existed. Thanks for building this thing that I and so many other people have needed. And thank you for building the people to do that with you. I'm just so grateful for your like leadership and the way you model collective joint principled leadership. It means a lot to me.
Thank you, Daniel. Well, thank you for being one of those people. When I hear your words, it means a lot to me, but it also, it's those are my words too. I just feel very, very blessed to be part of a place that allows me to be the kind of, you know, the kind of Jew that I want to be, that I think I should be. You probably could see that one of the ongoing themes in this conversation was it was never strategic. None of this happened by design. It was emergent. That's much better than random. Yeah.
We've been coasting off that for years.
I'm pretty intuitive, and I've learned how to trust my gut, and almost always it seems to help me land on my feet. So I feel very, very lucky to have folks who I've learned from that can help make this possible as well.
I have a big one to close us out with. You can respond to it either with the questions that are forming for you or the learnings that you now have. And I kind of want to trace the conversation that, like, to where we are now of, you know, this history you shared of solidarity work, of the Reconstructionist tradition, of, you know, claiming your people, of claiming who is not your people, what is happening in the world in the face of intolerable genocide. I am curious for you what you are questioning or what you are learning about power, trauma, healing, and solidarity as like a historical thrust from this moment.
Yeah. You know, the obvious answer is I always fall back on the power of relationship. You know, and that's the building block of not just organizing and creating community and creating movements, but just staying grounded in the world and being of use to yourself and those around you, that you need people, you need like-minded people who you enter into deep relationship with. And beyond that, I think it's, you know, I'm learning, it's just really important to create spaces that are either celebratory and joyful. I think that's not like a fun byproduct or nice if you can manage it, but it's absolutely essential that none of this works if we don't have joy at the center of it. And even in moments like this where it feels almost indulgent to create joyful spaces, that's when I think it's the most critical, you know. And Shabbat is a time where you're supposed to stop the work of the week and celebrate the world as it should be, you know, and celebration and joy is an integral part of that. And there are some times Shabbat rolls around and it just feels like, how can I do this? This feels privileged. It feels indulgent. And I always try to push through that. And I always am glad I do, because that's what fills us up to engage in that struggle and that work when Shabbat is over. And it's a really important thing we do in our congregation, but I think just in general in our movements, I think the successful movements, the movements that really, really work, are the ones that create space for celebration and joy and celebrating one another in the midst of that struggle. So that's really key to me as well. You know, especially, I said it before, I'll just say, especially at times like this, I think it's when we need it the most.
How can folks find you, the congregation, your work in the ways that you would like to be found?
Oh, you know, the usual places. Well, as I mentioned, I write this dusty old blog. Yeah,
so get you know, get some archaeological tools, you know.
You're prepared to type in www.
www. I'm on the World Wide Web. no, it's rabbibrant.com. And I my liturgy is on ynefesh.com. I started a new... I've been writing prayers for this moment, prayersforgaza.com. Tzedek Chicago, if you Googled Tzedek Chicago, T-Z-E-D-E-K, Chicago, you'll find our website. Websites are also a little bit passe, I know, but
it's got to be somewhere.
There's all kinds of, yeah, gotta have this information.
We all need a home.
Right. So that's one place you can connect with who we are and what we do.
And just a quick note on that for folks who are not in Chicago, one thing that Tzedek does is everything exists in a hybrid model. And so people all over the world who are looking for this home that we've talked about, it exists, it's accessible to you, find out information on their website.
Most of our membership is well outside of Chicago, and everything we do is online, sometimes exclusively, so...
Well, thank you so much for being here, sharing yourself.
Deeply grateful. Daniel, thanks you personally, but this struggle has been like a central part of like our bond and our learning. And I am really grateful for the community, the impact that you've had on my friend and partner in decriminalization, because it has made our work that much more true and authentic to the principles that we espouse and, you know, aspire to live out. So, you know, we've only met in passing a time or two, but, you know, your work has really impacted our space even indirectly. And so I'm very grateful for you.
Thank you, Damon. That means a lot to me. And thank you for inviting me to this conversation. It was really lovely. It's a great way for me to start my day.
All right, y'all. We'll be back reshaping the culture for the more liberatory and creative.
Much love to the people.
Peace.